this week's episode of Moral Victories, episode 12, we bring in David Hale of ESPN.com, college football writer. We talk about the ACC Coastal, the ACC, the conference that David covers closest. We talk about his gripes, our gripes, with the college football playoff system and whether it's Bama or the playoff that is truly ruining college football, as people have been saying on Twitter this week. With that, let's get to our episode.
Sports. The thrill of victory.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
The agony of defeat.
The Bears are who we thought they were.
Every loss teaches a lesson that's important for a young athlete's development.
I mean, I'm really disappointed in the fucking progress that we've made.
But it's important to remember that sports is about having fun, not winning.
You're here for one goddamn specific reason.
What's that, Earl?
Jack us!
Ah, you're full of shit. Fuck you.
This is Moral Victories with Jared Shanker.
You really think I give a flying what the people on the radio call say?
Welcome to Moral Victories. I am your host, Jared Shanker. On Twitter, at Jared_Shanker. That's where you'll be able to get the picks, which is what we talk about most on this show. But today, bringing in David Hale, a good friend of mine, a former colleague at ESPN, and a fellow degenerate gambler. We're going to talk about a whole host of things and then give a couple picks at the end of the year, at the end of the episode. Personally, 39 and 20 on the year. I've had a few rough weeks, but we're still solidly profitable, just a tick under 66% now, down from our high of 75, but we are going to get it back this week, I promise you that. But with that, let's get right to our interview with David, because it was a really good one, and I know you guys are going to want to hear it. And let's get right into it. Joined now by former colleague, still friend, still fellow degenerate gambler, David Hale, a college football writer at ESPN. College basketball now, too. We're going to talk mostly college football here, though. Although, recording on Tuesday, and there is a couple basketball games going on tonight. Real quick, who's going to win the national championship in basketball now that you're a expert in the field?
Duke Tucky, I think, is the team that I'm going with this year. I've put so little, like, it's so hard. You know how it is. Like, you're when you're covering football, like, you get so into the weeds.
Actually, I don't know how it is, Dave. I don't work at ESPN anymore. Thanks for bringing it up.
First of all, I wanted to point this out. If the majority of your income and the majority of my income is from gambling, aren't we still colleagues technically?
That is true. That is true. It's a rising tides float all boats. Did I say that right?
I don't know. It's,
I don't even know if really it applies here.
But anyway, my point being that you have been through covering football seasons and that it tends to be overwhelming. And I come out in like January and I'm supposed to write and talk about basketball. And I'm like, that's the one with the orange ball, right? And that's essentially as far as I can get with it. So I do think. I went up and I was at Duke's Midnight Madness a couple weeks ago, and it's funny having I've been around Clemson a lot this year, and they've got this like historically good defensive line, and then you see Zion Williamson, and he is effectively the exact same size as Christian Wilkins, and it's mind-boggling that this guy plays basketball at the level that he does and can jump like he does and has this, you know, outside perimeter game that is something you would expect from a guy who looks like Steve Nash, but he looks like Christian Wilkins. It's insane. So, I'm very excited. I'm not a Duke fan, but that team has some freshmen on it that I'm very excited to see play some college basketball this year.
That felt somewhat slanderous towards Steve Nash's jumping ability, but I'm going to move past that. No, you're right. College football, we're in the midst of it. So let's talk about the beauty of college football, these exciting races. The Big Ten West, the Pac-12 South, and the ACC Coastal. Which are you most excited for to play out? Because the Big West is, it looked like there was some clarity when Purdue beat Ohio State. It was like, okay, they're just going to run away with it now that Wisconsin is dead. That did not happen. Pac-12 South, I read today that it is actually possible that the division winner finishes under 500 in the conference. And is an ACC Coastal, they've just unlocked NFL parity, which is actually pretty impressive. And from what my understanding is, what makes the NFL so great, they are now a disaster as well, where Pitt or Virginia seem to be the favorites there. So which one is going to be, which one are you most excited to see just completely blow up over these last 3 weeks?
So, look, obviously I'm a Coastal Chaos fan. I have a appreciation for the ACC Coastal the way that people appreciate, like, 80s glam rock. Like, it is just so bad that I love it. But it's not the most interesting one this year. The Pac-12 South is the best because, as you said, we might see a winner finish under 500. It's possible we see a six-way 4-5 tie, which would be chef's kiss.
Oh, my God.
It's so good. But more than anything, what I want to see is a relatively bad Arizona State team led by Herm Edwards play for the Pac-12 championship and then somehow, like, upset Washington State or Washington in the Pac-12 championship game. I think it would be the most beautiful thing ever. Herm will have this elite-level post-game speech. Everyone will be like, oh, we were so wrong about Herm, and then they'll go 3-9 next year. Everything about it is so perfect.
Do you think Herm will think he's supposed to go to the Super Bowl? Because if you went, like, where he's from, if you win a conference championship, you go to the Super Bowl. So you think he's just going to be prepping? Like, he's like, I can't believe we got 3 months to prep.
Like, what happened here? Where am I? Why isn't anyone over here?
Well, now we're on to the Superdome, and we'll see you guys first week of February. It's like, no, actually, you're still in the Sun Bowl. You're going to be in El Paso on New Year's.
I mean, the upside for Arizona State is I'm not sure that Herm being there or not being there matters to whether they win or lose, but Herm being in college football makes college football better. Not the on-field stuff, but everything surrounding it. I'm excited about the prospect of a Herm Edwards Pac-12 championship.
Oh, that's going to be so great. Yeah, the Pac-12 South really did steal kind of the ethos of the ACC Coastal by the ACC Coastal's been trying to have a team win the division with a sub-500 record for like 8 years now, and they haven't been able to do it. And the Pac-12 South looks like they're on the cusp of that. But really, like I was saying before, I think the ACC Coastal really just has unlocked NFL parity. The last 5 years, a different team has won it. The only two that haven't, Pitt and Virginia, seem to be the most likely now. And I kind of feel like that's what makes the ACC Coastal so beautiful, is that each year you think you have an idea on it, and then it just completely blows up in your face. Like, Miami is a joke. Duke has been up and down. North Carolina, I don't even understand what's happened to that program. Virginia Tech, people expect it to kind of be bad, but I don't think anybody saw Pitt and Virginia be in the forefront at this division.
The best part, as you and I discussed last week, for the Pitt-Virginia game last Friday, I was very high on Pitt. And my only explanation for it was I've watched so much ACC Coastal football that I knew as soon as people were like, you know, Virginia's going to win this division, I was like, all right, now it's time to bet on somebody who is playing Virginia, because that's just how the ACC Coastal works. I remember before the season, people looking at Miami's win total for the year was, I think, 9, and people were looking at the schedule and saying, like, oh, that's the easiest money there is. How could Miami possibly lose 3 games against this terrible schedule? And then, you know, Florida State comes out and they're terrible, and they're like, oh, that was one of the only games that Miami possibly could lose, and they're terrible. So, of course, Miami, easy money. And I wish at the time I had thought, like, too many people are calling this easy money, I'm going the other way, because it was just clear as day that, like, if you've been around the ACC Coastal for any length of time, you know that whatever seems like the most reasonable outcome, bet against that.
That was, I didn't take any type of over or under on Miami before the year because I felt the same. I'd seen 9, I'd seen 9.5, and I'd seen 10. And I was like, you look at the schedule and you think there's really not any way that they should win less than 10. You could give them the loss to LSU. You could give them the loss to Florida State or Virginia Tech or somebody in the Coastal. But then you think about it, it's like, yeah, they're definitely just going to shit the bed and do what Coastal teams do. And that was the same reason why I took the under on Auburn, which is pretty much locked up at under 8.5. I can't remember what I have it at. But actually, they survived an extra week by coming back and beating Texas A&M. But that was the same thing I had with Auburn. You just know that they're just going to completely fold when everybody thinks that they should be good in 1 year.
Which, by the way, can we congratulate one another on our under pick for Stanford, which I think is officially a winner now. We got fingers crossed for this weekend. I'm really
it's a virtual high five
Tech because I had the under for Texas for much the same reason that you're talking about Auburn and Miami, is that, you know, setting the over-under for Texas at 9 wins, and you're like, no, this is still Texas we're talking about. So I need one more loss for Texas, and that'll be a nice little win for me as well. But, look, this is the point. It's like every year these teams that – and it's funny, you know, you talk about the analogy of the Pac-12 South and the ACC Coastal, and there's so much that's similar. You know, it's like, you know, Utah and Virginia Tech, both of them kind of out in the middle of nowhere, but consistently – you know, over-deliver, but, you know, the margin of error is so small for them. And then you've got Miami and USC that are supposed to be powers, but then they went through these NCAA sanctions, and they're never really quite gotten back, and we all believe in them every year only for them to let us down. And then you have, like, the whole group of, like, randoms that, like, hangs out and smokes in front of a 7-Eleven every night, you know, Arizona and Pittsburgh and stuff like that. It is the two divisions are actually very similar in a lot of respects.
I'm very curious if Pitt makes it into the college football playoff rankings. We're recording just before they come out, so we're not going to hit too much on what the actual rankings are going to be. I imagine the top four is going to look pretty close to what we saw last week, obviously with LSU not in there. But I know you've kind of voiced your opinion on top 25 before and maybe liking tiers versus an actual ranking, but maybe that's it, maybe it's not. But what is your biggest issue with how they do the college football playoff rankings? Because I have a few, but everybody's probably heard those already. What about you?
So there's a handful of things that I genuinely like and genuinely dislike about it. I think.
Let's start positive. You know, what do you like about it?
So what I like about it is that there is an eye test element of it. You know, that computers are very smart, right? And I think computers are very good and getting better all the time at creating an algorithm that lets us know, like, what is the input? What is, you know, how have teams, what's the talent level of teams based on recruiting rankings? What is the performance level of teams that underlies the final scores? All those things are good, but at the end of the day, the final score is also what matters, too. And computers don't always necessarily get that. You know, if you look at S&P Plus or the FBI, and you just look at, there's always a few outliers that you think, look, I see what you're getting at here. I understand where the math is here, but as a human being, I've watched these games and you're wrong on this, you know. Penn State, as I think, is not a terrible team, but Penn State was clearly not going to be a great team this year. And even after the first two losses, they were still, I think, top six in S&P Plus. So when you start looking at, like, the math of it, I don't think it always reflects what's actually happening on the field as well as they would like to believe it does. So I like the idea of the human element. I like the idea that there's somebody who comes out and talks about it and takes some accountability for it afterwards. What I don't like is that it is a sort of uniform room. There's a lot of people who are ADs and coaches or ex-ADs and ex-coaches, and that bothers me. I think you get better results by having a wider breadth of people. And I love Frank Beamer. I think Frank Beamer's a great dude. But if I sat down and tried to talk to Frank Beamer about S&P Plus or FPI or any of the advanced metrics of what goes into evaluating a college football team, his eyes would glaze over. That's not who Frank Beamer is. So I think, you know, you look at that room and you start talking to people about anything computer oriented, and most of them are going to be like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
I actually ranked milkshakes with Frank Beamer one time. He's a big cookout guy. That's his ideal meal. A hot dog, I think he said.
I don't disagree with him. He's not wrong about that. You know what? I take back what I said. You know what? He's probably smarter than any of the computers anyway.
You think he tries to steer the conversation like after like 3 hours on Sundays in Grapevine, Texas? He's like, so where do you guys fall on the milkshake discussion?
That's exactly what I think. I think he brings up the milkshakes. Everybody else like shoots that down. And then he's like, nah, I got to go walk my dog. I'll see y'all later. And then just bails. So I was up at Virginia Tech last year, and Frank's just out picking up dog crap because he was out walking his dog, Hank Beamer, by the way. He's just out walking his dog around campus. And he's out with like a plastic bag on his hand picking up dog crap for his little puppy. And I was like,
Did he have the reverse bag on his hand?
Yeah, the reverse bag. And it's just like, that's what I respect about a human being is when no matter how you might be the most famous citizen in a city, and it's not beneath you to go pick up your own dog's crap. So that's, you know,
anyway, defining character of a true salt of the earth guy.
He is salt of the earth. No doubt about that.
I was asking you, it was a natural tangent to Frank Beamer and milkshakes about what you dislike about the college football playoff ranking.
Yeah. So my biggest problem is that there are not criteria.
Yeah.
You know, there's no, this is how we select. This is what our priorities are. It changes depending on what team you want to talk about. You know, if you want to make Alabama number one, then the priorities or the criteria are XYZ. And if you want to make Clemson number one, then your priorities and criteria are ABC, and they are not applied uniformly. And, you know, again, I don't argue. To be honest with you, I think we have each year, the first 4 years of the playoff system, we have gotten four exceptional teams into the playoff, and they've been good football games. But I don't think that we have done it in any sort of a fair way. It's been kind of arbitrarily like, no, I think this team's better.
Yeah.
And if they would just say, that's how we're doing it, all right, that's fine.
Yeah, and I think that's what you see. That's how LSU ends up number four, because I feel like most people watch them, and as long as the Georgia game didn't completely skew your perception of them, you figured that they're probably not one of the four best teams in the country. But now, all right, as you change the methodology, well, you look at their resume, and it's like, all right, well, now because they have probably what is the most impressive resume if you just look at who they've played and what their record was, well, then we got to put them in the top four. But I don't, and I know you were not a fan of LSU as far as how good they really were previously. I was in the same boat that I just don't think that they were really ever that good. But like you said, the methodology kind of changes, and it's like, all right, well, we think Team X is probably just one of the best four because we've seen them play. But then we're going to throw LSU in there because they just have the best resume.
Yeah, and I'm fine if you want to say best resume. I'm fine if you want to say it's the best team that we saw. I'm fine if you want to say it's a 50-50 split of the two. But it's never that. It's a different criteria depending on which team we're talking about. And look, the truth be told, if you wanted to go, let's take last week's rankings. If you wanted to go by what is the best, you know, who has the best win combined with not having any losses, you know, Clemson's resume was better than Alabama's by every possible metric. But if you watched Alabama play this year, how do you not say that's the best team in the country? I get where the problem is, but, you know, as you said with LSU, like, you know, I know they're not that good offensively. They're a below average offensive team. They're an elite defensive team, and they won a bunch of good games against good teams. So are we not going to reward them for that? You know, it's like with UCF last year, and I am certainly not an advocate that I think UCF was going to go out and win the college football playoff last year. But the only reason that they're not in is because we decided that they weren't good enough to be in. There was no metric that showed that. You know, like, strength of schedule, all right, fine. You know, if Mike Tyson just fought a bunch of, like, eight-year-olds during the 80s, you would have said, well, he hasn't fought anyone. That doesn't change the fact that he was a great fighter then. You know, if the Patriots played Kent State every week, it wouldn't change the fact that the Patriots are good. They just have a weak strength of schedule. So I am very much of the opinion that the playoff should be about giving teams that have warranted an opportunity a chance to prove themselves on the field. And so, you know, I think LSU had done that by playing enough good teams and beating them. I think UCF had done that last year by not losing to anyone. But so the criteria has to change a little bit. But I just hate that it's sort of like as propped up as this thing that actually means something. And it's not. It's, at the end of the day, it's human opinion. And that's fine. But, like, call it what it is.
Yeah. Actually, you mentioned, of course, that Bama had to be number one just because you see them play. And it's so clear that they are far and away the best team in the country so far. And that spiked. And I've had the sort of the conversation, I've said it before, that Alabama has ruined college football this year. But I think, and I say that in jest, but I think if you really kind of feel that way, the actual argument is that the playoff has ruined college football for you if you think that Bama is ruining college football. Because in most years, like, the playoff is set up for Bama to win it every year when you bring it to four teams. Because generally, they're going to be in that top four. Under the old way with the BCS, when if Bama loses at any point in the year, it's 50-50 maybe, where they get back into the top two and play for the national championship. So I don't look at it as Bama ruining college football. I think if you feel that way, it's that the playoff has ruined college football. And I wonder, 4 years in, what your if you're of the same thinking there, or like if you 4 years in you feel like the playoff has been and this amazing thing for college football. If you get what I'm saying, as far as it's not right. Bama, it's the college football playoff that people actually hate, because it's going to guarantee that the very best team, which right now is going to be Bama pretty much every year, is almost guaranteed to make the playoff, barring something pretty unforeseen.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was doing some sort of like historical research on Bama and Clemson today, and I was looking at the 2013 Bama team, which was a really, really good football team, and they lost to Auburn on the kick six. And they didn't get a chance to play for the SEC title or the national title. Well, I mean, we have to look no further than last year, where the same thing, I mean, they actually got beat by Auburn last year and still made it into the playoff, as opposed to this fluky play that got them beat. So you go to 2013 and you look at how that year played out. There's no question Bama was one of the top four teams in 2013. They would have been in the playoff if the playoff had existed a year earlier. They would have probably been playing Florida State in the playoff, if not the national championship game, as opposed to Auburn. It would have been a much different conversation. The only reason that Alabama doesn't have a 2013 national championship is because they didn't get a chance because they lost one game on a very fluky play at the end of the year to Auburn. So I agree with you. I think the playoff has helped Alabama to ensure that they can have an off week and still make the playoff. But, you know, if you ask, you know, isn't the goal of any season and any postseason to identify who is the best team? Well, even if you're sick of Alabama, even if you're the biggest Alabama hater in the world, it's hard not to argue that Alabama's been the best team. I mean, they are the best team. So what we're really asking is, is there a system that makes it more interesting than just saying, well, damn, Alabama's the best team again? Like, that's really what we're asking. And, you know, from a television standpoint or from a media standpoint or from expanding the popularity of the sports standpoint, I'm not sure that how good Alabama is good. But I don't know that you necessarily blame any system. I mean, theoretically, the playoff is getting it right. But the bigger issue, I think, is all of the underlying things that go with it in terms of money and access and locality and all of the things that go into a good program. So, you know, I don't know. That's a really cop-out answer, but that's where I am on things.
I think the playoff is doing exactly what it's supposed to do as far as getting the four best teams in there. But just unlike the NCAA tournament where you have to win six, in this one, you only have to win two. The likelihood that a team that is clearly the best but get knocked off is so much lower than the NCAA tournament. It's almost like the college football playoff is too far geared toward the very top of the crust, and the NCAA tournament doesn't favor them enough by making them play six games. I'm not saying that the playoff is necessarily a bad thing, but it has removed somewhat of the, I guess, fluidity at the top or in a national championship setting. Which
right. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because when you think about it, it's a question of what do we really want out of this, right? Like a 162-game MLB season and a team that finishes with 114 wins or whatever, that's the best team. There's no question about it. But then we make them go and play these 7-game or 5-game series where, you know, you have it, the setup is completely different than the regular season and you have maybe a pitcher who gets hot or whatever. It's different, right? And the point is that it kind of throws everything up into the air to see where it lands. I mean, it's much more random chance, and college basketball is the perfect example of that. The reason that we love the tournament is because it is much more random. And so, you know, a lot of it comes down to what is the conversation we're really having about this? Because I think if you ask any fan, like, what do you want your postseason to do? Do you want it to be like, what is the goal of the postseason? And they'll say, well, it's to identify who the best team was. Yeah, that's what the regular season does. The postseason is about, like, the entertainment value of it, of I don't know what's going to happen, and seeing heroic moments and all of that. And Alabama doesn't provide us a whole lot of that. Like, Alabama is just a steamroller, and there's no fun in watching a steamroller steamroll thing.
I think the other thing that is interesting, I think people will change mid-season. As far as the question that you just posed, what do you want to get out of your year? So I think before the year, if you ask most people what is your hope outside of like Ohio State, Alabama, and a few other programs, it's like they're happy if they make conference championship, win a conference championship, and play in one of those other New Year's Six games. But then once you get to like 4-0 or 5-0, then if you don't make the playoff, it's like, well, all right, we did win the conference championship and we did play in the Orange Bowl. But now that's kind of disappointing. And that was sort of the thing. I've kind of tried staying out of all type of Twitter discussion / arguments when I saw people refuting the has Bama ruined the college football playoff by saying, well, there's so many other great things about college football that outside of just the playoff. But then I feel like once outside of the group of five, once your team has any type of sort of success, the vision for your season flips so much to focus on the playoff. And that's, I guess,
yeah, no, you're 100%. I mean, look at Miami last year. They won 10 games for the first time in forever. They play in an Orange Bowl. They played for they finally got the monkey off their back about an ACC division title. But because of how they started, the conversation changed so much that I think that 10-2 season became a disappointment.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm saying there. And even like Auburn last year, where they had a good year, which is honestly an outlier for that program over the last however many years.
Yeah.
And then it's like looked at as like, well, we did beat Bama, but we came out and laid an egg against UCF. And that brings me to my next thing here. We're gonna hire and fire some coaches. First one, Gus Malzahn. Let's throw away the entire money issue. Would you, if you're Auburn and you just could write a blank check to get rid of Gus Malzahn, would you do it at the end of the year? I would.
I think I would, but what I really think is they probably should have done it 2 years ago and didn't.
I think everybody in that the decision makers there regret what happened last year. That November, I think, was the worst thing that could have happened to them, and I think they know that.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And look, I mean, that's the problem that with Gus Malzahn. He's beaten at Bama. He has more success against Bama than pretty much anyone over the last decade. But then he goes out and loses handily to Tennessee this year. I mean, this is not a program that you feel good about. It's not a program that you feel like consistently plays for championships. And if that's the goal, then, yeah, I mean, I he's not the guy to me. But, you know, the other thing I always ask in a situation like this where you're talking about getting rid of a guy who has had some success is, who's the guy? Who is the guy then?
Yeah,
and that's where if I'm Alabama, you know, there's plenty of other programs around the country that need to fire a coach, and they'll find a better guy. If you're at Auburn, much like with Florida State last year when everybody was happy to see Jimbo Fisher go, I think the question is not, are you happy to see them go? That's fine. But then who are you going to replace him with? Because the list of candidates that you should be looking at is so small, and the number of people who have done or have a reasonable expectation of doing what your expectation of success is every year is three or four guys. I mean, legitimately three or four guys nationally.
And that's actually, I don't even know who Auburn, if you had a dream list of who Auburn can get, I don't even know who would be on there, because I'm not sure there is anybody that strikes me immediately as somebody that would be a fit for a place like Auburn right now that's actually somewhat realistic. I don't know who that next amazing coach is that would come in and fix Auburn. I don't, does anybody come to mind for you?
I mean, Chris Peterson would probably be the number one guy that I think is both gettable and has that level of like potential. But then you're talking about a guy that you're bringing who has had his entire career in the Northwest and bringing him to the Southeast and saying, like, do it here. I mean, he has been, I think he's an exceptional coach, but he's also done it in a media market that is not anywhere near what Auburn would be for the pressure that is on that job. You know, Jimbo would have probably been a good fit, but that's not happening now. So, you know, you're right. I don't know. I don't know who would possibly take that job that you would say, I feel pretty confident that this guy is going to get us to the next level.
I would think it would have to, like, the only one that really jumps out to me, and I didn't say it because I was saving it for this segue, this lead-in, is Jeff Brohm. But it would seem like if he's going to go anywhere, it's going to be to Louisville, which brings me to the next point. You had this crazy stat on, like, the consecutive losses that Louisville has had by however many points, and I will tee you up to give me that and then answer the question of whether Bobby has to ride his motorcycle out of town.
Just throw three.
The low-hanging fruit. I had to. Low-hanging fruit.
The best I can rip off from this stat, I think, if Syracuse covers this week, which they're like a 22-point favorite, Louisville will have lost five straight games by 18 points or more. They would be the, I believe, fifth or sixth team that would have done that in the last decade. So there's a couple of teams that fired their coaches right after that. But the ones that kept their coaches, Mike Gundy was one, Mike Leach, maybe I'm wrong about Mike Leach. Anyway, handful of coaches that had kept their job. They all
Rich Rod, I think, was one you named.
What's that? Oh, yeah.
Rich Rod.
So, yeah. So they're all of them improved by at least three games the next year. So there is some precedent to say, like, all right, this is an aberration when you have an established coach and this happens. Now, my personal opinion on the Bobby Petrino and Louisville situation is that this is not an aberration. This is sort of the trend that was covered up by Lamar Jackson. And that, you know, I don't think that Bobby Petrino in this situation is going to get the assistant coaching staff any better than what he already has it. People don't want to go and work for him, and they don't want to go and work in a sinking ship. So I think a change absolutely has to be made at Louisville. Now, this would be my question for you. Do you think Louisville is a legitimately better job than Purdue right now?
Well, first off, this is my show. I ask the questions, Dave.
Sorry. I was trying to include you in the conversation.
No. I do believe so, because I think you can, although the areas are very close to each other and Louisville is going to recruit Indianapolis very heavily, I think that, and I understand that Jeff Brohm has gotten much more financial support than a lot of other people, and I guess if you look at the history of the programs, I can't say this for sure, but I would think that Purdue has a more storied history there as far as football goes, but I think when push comes to shove, when it's time for boosters and donors to open their pockets, I think Louisville will be much more capable of acquiescing to what Jeff Brohm would want than Purdue. And I say this as an outsider. I don't really know what the donor booster situation is at Purdue, but I know what it is like at a place like Louisville, and I believe that would make it a more sought after job than a place like Purdue. Although Brohm is a great fit there, I don't think what he feels like he can accomplish at Purdue is equal to what he thinks he could accomplish at a place like Louisville.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But then, you know, the flip side of that is, as we were discussing with Auburn, you know, nobody sees the jobs that come open. There's always a handful of big jobs that come open that maybe we're not expecting or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like the Louisville fans have already, like, you know, bought their Jeff Brom jerseys.
Oh, they already think he's coming back.
Yeah, and I think there's as much a chance that he, I would say at this point, if I'm breaking it down, I think it's about a one-third chance he stays at Purdue, a one-third chance he ends up at Louisville, and a one-third chance he ends up somewhere else.
It reminds me of Notre Dame and Urban back in 2005, where people were like, oh, well, he's just going to come to Notre Dame because he has such an emotional tie there, and that's a slam dunk, that's a home run. And people kind of forgot that they're actually, like, one, that these guys are a little bit further removed, and that for every Scott Frost, there's a lot more guys that are going to make the best business decision versus the one just going back home.
Right, right. That's and look, it's a double-edged sword to go back home, too, because, I mean, you look at Scott Frost, and, I mean, I think if you look at and watch Nebraska play this year, they're a much better team this year than last year. But the expectations were so ratcheted up about Scott Frost that people are like angry with him about how they performed this year. I mean, you know, you've got people talking six games in about whether or not this was a mistake. I don't think you get that necessarily with another guy. There is a pressure that comes on the hometown guy coming home that doesn't exist necessarily for other guys. And look, you look at Louisville right now, and I don't know that that's a quick turnaround either. I think that's a legitimate cultural problem as much as it is a personnel problem, and there's a lot of work to be done by whoever takes over that program.
Yeah, I think that's a few years that it's going to take a turnaround. A quick yes or no, because I want to get on to the last guy I have on the list, whether we're going to can him. Clay Helton, yes or no, would you bring him back at USC?
I would bring him back. I think he is undervalued. I'm not sure if he's the answer, but again, I'm not sure what the better answer is there. Unless the only thing I can see at USC is if they have an opportunity to go after like an NFL guy that might come available, like a John Harbaugh might be somebody that I would look at. But if that's
Jack Del Rio,
if you don't get Jeff Fisher, it's time for Jeff Fisher. Damn it.
Also, by the way, I said yes or no. Just give me a quick yes or no, and I think you gave us two minutes.
Yeah.
And then the last one.
What I meant to hear, we can edit it out later. No.
Okay. Last one, and you can't fire him, but I think you would just have to just change the locks of the building. Bill Snyder at Kansas State. They're 1-5 in the conference. They've had a bunch of quarterback issues. There's the rumors of a fractured relationship with administration about who we might want to replace him eventually. How would you handle this situation? I think the best way is just to be like, no, man, we told you at the beginning of the year this was it. We changed the locks on you.
I don't even think you need to change the locks. You just need to replace the locks with like a digital thing or like a fingerprint scanner, and he'll be so confused by it that he'll just be like, well, I guess I don't work here anymore.
He doesn't trust the technology. It's like, no, it's a finger scan. Yeah. Like, no. I've seen this played out before.
You know, Kansas State's an interesting – I mean, it, to me, it's a little bit like Florida State light, because when they got rid of Bowden, I mean, how do you get rid of Bowden,
yeah,
you know? But – and that's how they are at Kansas State. But, you know, I think what you have to do is essentially say, look, you can stay here another 50 years if you want. We're not hiring your kid as head coach. It's not happening. So if that's what's keeping you here, then it's time to move on. I think that he warrants the level of respect that he has there. And I don't think you're going to go get somebody. I mean, they've been down this road before where, you know, when he retired the first time, and that program became a complete and total train wreck. I mean,
yeah,
it's bad now, but it was a train wreck then,
with Ron Prince. And I think that's why you just, like, if he ends up running this thing into the ground, you just have to let him do it, because probably more likely than not, no matter who the next coach is there, like, ultimately it's Kansas State. It is such a difficult place to win there. Like, honestly, they probably should be close to Kansas because of everything that's against them, and he's just been able to defy the human odds as far as getting that program to the heights that it has. Even like as far as, I think it was 2003 when they went to that Fiesta Bowl. I can't remember the year exactly, but that they're so far removed from even that as far as what they can actually accomplish at this point, that like if he goes 6-6, that's still like a magnificent accomplishment, and that it probably isn't looked at in that way. But yeah, I would say even if he runs this thing into the ground and coaches there for another 8-10 years, you just got to let him do it at this point.
I mean, it's sort of like the Paterno situation at Penn State, you know, pre the scandal of like, how do you tell Joe he's got to go no matter what the trajectory of the team is? I mean, he is the guy who made the program. And look, maybe the standard for Kansas State is the ground. You know, if he runs it into the ground, that's just him running it to where it belonged in the first place. So, you know, I like, if you look at, like, honestly, what are the worst jobs, Power 5 jobs? What are the worst Power 5 jobs in the country?
Don't you dare say Rutgers.
I mean, don't you think, like, the right coach with the right, like there's potential at Rutgers if you had the right people there.
No, I do agree there. There's enough talent in that Northeast section there where you could at least be, you could be what Maryland is. You know, you could, if you win 7-8 games.
And you're making Big Ten money there. You're not making that kind of money at Kansas State. I mean, I don't know that Kansas State is the worst job, but it is definitely in the mix. Like, and at least, like, you know, there's a level of like recruit that you can say, like, hey, don't you want to be close to New York City? Like, if you have a, you become a star here, you're a star in New York. You know, I mean, there's something to be said for that. Like, if you're a star in Manhattan, Kansas, what does that really mean for you? I mean, I don't know that it's the worst job, but it is definitely not. It's definitely bottom five.
It's bottom five.
No doubt about it.
Probably them, like, probably a lot of the Big 12 schools, just by being in those flyover states. Iowa State, awesome, like, awesome fan base, awesome situation they have now, but lose Matt Campbell, they're probably going back to 2-10 most years. Kansas 2-10, Kansas State 2-10. Yeah, I guess.
I mean, that's the thing. A lot of these programs, you're catching lightning in a bottle with a coach for a little while, and you got to hope that that coach has built enough of a cultural infrastructure that you can bring somebody else in who can maintain and build upon that foundation. But, you know, and that's why, you know, the second hire is probably almost more important than the first one. You know, I mean, if you don't do that, I don't know what the long-term answer is in a lot of those places. And I can tell you that, like, bringing in, you know, legendary coach's son, like, Florida State hiring Jeff Bowden or any of the other Bowdens would have been an epic disaster. South Carolina hiring Spurrier's son would have been an epic disaster. Virginia Tech hiring Beamer's son would have been an epic disaster. So it's just, you know, it's amazing to me how many coaches think that this is a thing that they're going to make happen. And I'm not sure of a situation in which it ever has happened. But then when it, I can't imagine another situation, even if it did happen, where it would work out well.
Ooh, you bringing that up just made me think of Kansas should hire Charlie Weiss's son. Now that he's come up through the through the Saban mentorship program, and I think he's at FAU now as the offensive coordinator.
Oh my God, I love this. First of all, as someone who has wagered on FAU too many times this year,
I'm taking him this week, I think.
I will say I took them the money line last week against FIU, and they did finally pay out. So I'm like 1-4 on them this year. But
that's me in Mississippi State. I've never won a Mississippi State bet since the 2016 Egg Bowl. They were like a 10-point they were a 10-point underdog, and I took them outright to beat Ole Miss. I've lost every single game on them since, including this past weekend.
I'm a firm believer that, like, money lines eventually screw you 10 times over. Like, you're like, yes, I want a nice little money line bet. And then you're like, that team really took care of me. And then you go and bet them, like, the next 15 times they're going to lose.
Forever in debt to Mississippi State. Speaking of which, real quick, I don't know if you had a chance to look through some games this week, see what you'd like. I'll rattle off a few that I like for our listeners. Fresno State giving 2.5 at Boise State. Maybe I'm crazy thinking that Fresno State's the best Group of Five team because they don't play the same type of competition as UCF, and UCF did beat the hell out of Pitt. Fresno did lose to Minnesota, and I don't even know how that happened. But at least it's west of the Mississippi, they are the best Group of Five team. I think they're balanced better than Boise State at this point. Boise State's not what they were under Peterson with Harsin there. No offense to – this is probably what we talked about before, where Harsin has just kind of – they've kind of fallen back to where they should be, even probably still above where they should be under Harsin. That's one I like. Sticking with the Group of Five schools, Liberty getting 24 against Virginia. I'm not sure Virginia should – be giving anybody 24, but that also seems kind of funky. So I don't know if I'll end up playing that one. Baylor getting 14.5 at Iowa State. I, for some reason, can't quit UNC. I kind of like them getting 10.5 against their rival Duke. Washington State given 4.5 at Colorado. Auburn, Georgia under 50. FAU given 18. And the Arizona State, UCLA under 59.5. And, I mean, it's only Tuesday. I will never be held to these picks because, honestly, I haven't really looked into them a ton. They kind of are the ones that jumped out at me at first. But I don't know if you've had a chance to look and anything strike you so far.
I'm kind of actually on the opposite end of the Fresno-Boise game with you. First of all, you know, this is I saw this on Twitter the other day, or yesterday, I think, that this is the first time Boise has been a home underdog of the blue turf in more than a decade. That is something.
That is kind of scary.
Yeah, so I kind of look at it like, man, I'm with you, and I've faded Boise a lot this year with negligible results, but I think I'm on Boise. I am with you on North Carolina. Duke won that game against a bad Miami team in terrible weather last week,
yep.
Which somehow like made everyone forget that they'd looked like crap the 2 weeks before that. I'm with you. I think UNC has a win coming to them. They have not played as bad as the record would suggest. I think they beat Duke outright, actually. And I will say the other team that I want to take this week, and I know I shouldn't because this is speaking of teams that have screwed me this year, especially as road favorites, is Ohio State. I think that they are going to be angry coming off of this Nebraska game. I think Urban is going to light into them. I think Michigan State's offense is terrible, which helps out what is, I think, a relatively lackluster Ohio State defense. I think Dwayne Haskins is going to have a big game. I'm on Ohio State with a relatively low number. I think it's 3.5 right now.
Yep.
So that's the other team that I'm looking at right now, which I know, again, I've convinced myself to take Ohio State as a road favorite multiple times this year. They've screwed me every single one of those times, but I'm back on the horse.
I've thought the same. I think I might just be scarred with Ohio State at this point. I've taken them a few times too. I don't know what my record is with them, but it's not great. And I was actually felt very good about the one last week. And if you look at actually how the game played out with turnovers in Nebraska territory, they probably should cover under normal circumstances. But I think that's just what this team is. I just don't think they are a team that can get out of its own way. And then I wonder, when you play a team like Michigan State, as bad as their offense is, and that their defense is better against the run than against the pass, and that's kind of opposite of how you'd want to be playing Ohio State. Michigan State, they beat teams that can't get out of their own way. That's like literally how they beat them. And
yeah. For
me, that's probably I'll probably end up staying away from that game.
Well, you might be a smarter man than me. I think we've probably actually officially decided that's probably the case, but I think I'm back on board. I'm like that guy who just keeps doubling down until he finally wins something. So
no, I appreciate your stubbornness. I've done that many many times with games, especially a lot of second half bets there too. Like, oh, yeah.
Oh,
no, they'll come back in the second half. No worries.
Ohio State felt that was for me as well.
Well, hey, man, as always, it's always fun when you come on. I appreciate you taking some time today and hanging out with us.
My pleasure as always, sir. You let me know whenever you want, and one time out of every four, I will definitely do it.
That's what I want to hear. All right, man, appreciate it. That is our show. That wraps up episode numero doce of the Moral Victories podcast. Tune in next week. We release episodes every Thursday. Download, subscribe, give us 5 stars, and we'll be sure to fill your inbox every week with a little bit of fun, a little bit of gambling picks. Be sure to follow me online on Twitter, Jared_Schenker, where we'll be able to get the official picks for week, I believe, is 11. That's our show. Thanks.